If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 7, Part 3 of The Idiot by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Ali Mekki. Chapter 7. I had a small pocket pistol. I had procured it while still a boy at that droll age when the stories of duels and highwaymen begin to delight one, and when one imagines oneself nobly standing fire at some future day in a duel. There were a couple of old bullets in the bag which contained the pistol, and powder enough in an old flask for 2 or 3 charges. The pistol was a wretched thing, very crooked, and wouldn't carry farther than 15 paces at the most. However, it would send your skull flying well enough if you pressed the nozzle of it against your temple. I determined to die at Pavlovsk at sunrise in the park, so as to make no commotion in the house. This explanation will make the matter clear enough to the police. Students of psychology, and anyone else who likes, may make what they please of it. I should not like this paper, however, to be made public. I request the prince to keep a copy himself, and to give a copy to Aglaya Ivanovna Epanchin. This is my last will and testament. As for my skeleton, I bequeath it to the Medical Academy for the benefit of science. I recognize no jurisdiction over myself, and I know that I am now beyond the power of laws and judges. A little while ago, a very amusing idea struck me. What if I were now to commit some terrible crime, murder 10 fellow creatures, for instance, or anything else that is thought most shocking and dreadful in this world? What a dilemma my judges would be in, with a criminal who only has a fortnight to live in any case, know that the rack and other forms of torture are abolished. Why, I should die comfortably in their own hospital, in a warm, clean room, with an attentive doctor, probably much more comfortably than I should at home. I do not understand why people in my position do not oftener indulge in such ideas, if only for a joke. Perhaps they do, who knows? There are plenty of merry souls among us. But though I do not recognize any jurisdiction over myself, I still know that I shall be judged, when I am nothing but a voiceless lump of clay. Therefore I do not wish to go before I have left a word of reply. The reply of a free man, not one forced to justify himself. Oh, no. I have no need to ask forgiveness of anyone. I have wished to say a word merely because I happen to desire it of my own free will. Here, in the first place, comes a strange thought. Who in the name of what law would think of disputing my full personal right over the fortnight of life left to me? What jurisdiction can be brought to bear upon the case? Who would wish me not only to be sentenced, but to endure the sentence to the end? Surely there exists no man who would wish such a thing, and why should anyone desire it? For the sake of morality? Well, I can understand that, if I were to make an attempt upon my own life while in the enjoyment of full health and vigour, my life, which might have been useful, etc., etc. Morality might reproach me, according to the old routine, for disposing my own life without permission, or whatever its tenet may be. But now, when my sentence is out and my days are numbered, how can morality have need for my last breaths? And why should I die listening to the consolations offered by the prince, who without doubt would not omit to demonstrate that death is actually a benefactor to me? Christians like him always end up with that. It is their pet theory. And what do they want with their ridiculous Pavlovsk trees? To sweeten my last hours? Cannot they understand that the more I forget myself, the more I let myself become attached to these last illusions of life and love, by means of which they try to hide from me Meyer's wall, and all that is so plainly written on it, the more unhappy they make me? What is the use of all your nature to me, all your parks and trees, your sunsets and sunrises, your blue skies and your self-satisfied faces, when all this wealth of beauty and happiness begins with the fact that it accounts me only me, one to many? What is the good of all this beauty and glory to me, when every second, every moment, I cannot but be aware that this little fly which buzzes round my head in the sun's rays, even this little fly, is a sharer and participator in all the glory of the universe, and knows its place and is happy in it, while I, only I, am an outcast, and have been blind to the fact hitherto, thanks to my simplicity? Oh, I know well how the prince and others would like me, instead of indulging in all these wicked words of my own, to sing to the glory and triumph of morality that well-known verse of Gilbert's, "Oh, puissant voix, longtemps votre beauté sacrée, tant d'amis sourds à mes adieux, qui me rend plein de joie, qui leur mort soit pleurée, qu'un ami leur femme l'ayeu." But believe me, my simple-hearted friends, that in this highly moral verse, in this academical blessing to the world in general, in the French language, is hidden the intensest gall and bitterness. But so well concealed is the venom that I dare say the poet actually persuaded himself that his words were full of the tears of pardon and peace, instead of the bitterness of disappointment and malice, and so died in the delusion. Do you know there is a limit of ignominy beyond which man's consciousness of shame cannot go, after which begins satisfaction in shame? Well, of course, humility is a great force in that sense, I admit that, though not in the sense in which religion accounts humility to be a strength. Religion, I admit eternal life, and perhaps I always did admit it that consciousness is called into existence by the will of a higher power, admit it that this consciousness looks out upon the world and says, "I am," and admit it that the higher power wills that the consciousness so called into existence be suddenly extinguished for some explained reason. It is and must be. Still, there comes the eternal question, why must I be humble through this? Is it not enough that I am devoured, without my being expected to bless the power that devours me? Surely, I need not suppose that somebody there will be offended because I do not wish to live out the fortnight allowed me. I don't believe it. It is much simpler and far more likely to believe that my death is needed, the death of an insignificant atom, in order to fulfill the general harmony of the universe, in order to make even some plus or minus in the sum of existence, just as every day the death of numbers of beings is necessary, because without their annihilation the rest cannot live on. Although we must admit that the idea is not a particularly grand one in itself. However, I admit the fact. Admit that, without such perpetual devouring of one another, the world cannot continue to exist, or could have never been organized. I am ready to confess that I cannot understand why this is so, but I tell you what I do know for certain. If I have once been given to understand and realize that I am, what does it matter to me that the world is organized on a system full of errors, and that otherwise it cannot be organized at all? Who will or can judge me after this? Say what you like, the thing is impossible and unjust. And meanwhile, I have never been able, in spite of my great desire to do so, to persuade myself that there is no future existence and no providence. The fact of the matter is that all this does exist, but that we know absolutely nothing about the future life and its laws. But it is so difficult and even impossible to understand that surely I am not to be blamed because I could not fathom the incomprehensible. Of course, I know they say that one must be obedient, and of course, too, the prince is one of those who say so, that one must be obedient without questions, out of pure goodness of heart, and that for my worthy conduct in this matter I shall meet with a reward in another world. We degrade God when we attribute our own ideas to him, out of annoyance that we cannot fathom his ways. Again, I repeat, I cannot be blamed because I am unable to understand that which is not given to mankind to fathom. Why am I to be judged because I could not comprehend the will and laws of providence? No, we had better drop religion. Enough of this. By the time I have got so far in the reading of my document, the sun will be up and the huge force of his rays will be acting upon the living world. So be it. I shall die gazing straight at the great fountain of life and power. I do not want this life. If I had had the power to prevent my own birth, I should certainly never have consented to accept existence under such ridiculous conditions. However, I have the power to end my existence, although I do but give back days that are already numbered. It is an insignificant gift, and my revolt is equally insignificant. Final explanation. I die not in the least because I am unable to support these next 3 weeks, so no, I should find strength enough, and if I wished it, I could obtain consolation from the thought of the injury that is done me. But I am not a French poet, and I do not desire such consolation. And finally, nature has limited my capacity for work or activity of any kind in allotting me but 3 weeks of time. That suicide is the only thing that I can begin and end in the time of my own free will. Perhaps, then, I am anxious to take advantage of my last chance of doing something for myself. A protest is sometimes no small thing. The explanation was finished. Hippolyte paused at last. There is, in extreme cases, a final stage of cynical candor, when a nervous man, excited and beside himself with emotion, will be afraid of nothing and ready for any sort of scandal, nay, glad of it. The extraordinary, almost unnatural tension of the nerves which upheld Hippolyte up to this point has now arrived at this final stage. This poor, feeble boy of 18, exhausted by disease, looked for all the world as weak and frail as a leaflet torn from its parent tree and trembling in the breeze. But no sooner had his eyes swept over his audience for the first time during the whole of the last hour than the most contemptuous, the most haughty expression of repugnance lighted up his face. He defied them all, as it were. But his hearers were indignant too. They rose to their feet with annoyance. Fatigue, the wine consumed, the strain of listening so long, all added to the disagreeable impression which the reading had made upon them. Suddenly Hippolyte jumped up as though he had been shot. "The sun is rising," he cried, seeing the gilded tops of the trees and pointing to them as to a miracle. "See, it is rising now." "Well, what then? Did you suppose it wasn't going to rise?" asked Ferdishenko.
"It's going to be atrociously hot again all day," said Gania, with an air of annoyance, taking his hat. "A month of this. Are you coming home, Titsin?"
Hippolyte listened to this in amazement, almost amounting to stupefaction. Suddenly he became doubly pale and shuddered. "You manage your composure too awkwardly. I see you wish to insult me," he cried to Gania. "You're a cur." He looked at Gania with an expression of malice.
"What on earth is the matter with you, boy? What phenomenal feeble-mindedness!" exclaimed Ferdishenko.
"Oh, he's simply a fool," said Gania.
Hippolyte braced himself up a little. "I understand, gentlemen," he began, trembling as before and stumbling over every word, "that I have deserved your resentment, and I'm sorry that I should have troubled you with this raving nonsense," pointing to the article, "or rather, I'm sorry that I have not troubled you enough." He smiled feebly. "Have I troubled you, Evgeny Pavlovitch?" He suddenly turned on Evgeny with this question. "Tell me now, have I troubled you or not?"
"Well, it was a little drawn out, perhaps, but—"
"Come, speak out, don't lie, for once in your life, speak out," continued Hippolyte, quivering with agitation.
Oh, my good sir, I assure you it's entirely the same to me. Please leave me in peace, said Evgenie angrily, turning his back on him. Good night, prince, said Ptitsin, approaching his host.
What are you thinking of? Don't go, he'll blow his brains out in a minute,
cried Vera Lebedev, rushing up to Hippolyte and catching hold of his hands in a torment of alarm.
What are you thinking of? He said he would blow his brains out at sunrise.
Oh, he won't shoot himself, cried several voices sarcastically.
Gentlemen, you better look out, cried Kolia, also seizing Hippolyte by the hand. Just look at him, prince. What are you thinking of?
Vera and Kolia and Keller and Burdovsky were all crowding round Hippolyte now and holding him down. He has the right, murmured Burdovsky.
Excuse me, prince, but what are your arrangements?
Asked Lebedev, tipsy and exasperated, going up to Mishkin.
What do you mean by arrangements?
No, no, excuse me, I'm master of this house, though I do not wish to lack respect towards you. You are master of the house too, in a way, but I can't allow this sort of thing.
He won't shoot himself, the boy is only playing the fool, said General Ivolgin suddenly and unexpectedly, with indignation.
I know he won't, General, but I'm master here.
Listen, Mr. Terentiev, said Ptitsin, who had bidden the prince good night and was now holding out his hand to Hippolyte. I think you remark in that manuscript of yours that you bequeath your skeleton to the academy. Are you referring to your own skeleton? I mean your very bones?
Yes, my bones.
Quite so, I see, because you know little mistakes have occurred now and then. There was a case...
Why do you tease him? Cried the prince suddenly.
You've moved him to tears, added
Ferdishenko, but Hippolyte was by no means weeping. He was about to move from his place when his four guards rushed at him and seized him once more. There was a laugh at this. He led up to this on purpose. He took the trouble of writing all that so that people should come and grab him by the arm, observed Rogojin. Good night, prince. What a time we've sat here. My very bones ache.
If you really intended to shoot yourself, Terentiev, said Evgeny Pavlovich, laughing,
if I were you, after all these compliments, I should just not shoot myself in order to vex them all.
They're very anxious to see me blow my brains out, said Hippolyte bitterly.
Yes, they'll be awfully annoyed if they don't see it.
Then you think they won't see it?
I am not trying to egg you on the contrary, I think it's very likely that you may shoot yourself, but the principal thing is to keep cool, said Evgenie with a drawl, and with great condescension.
I only now perceive what a terrible mistake I made in reading this article to them, said Hippolyte suddenly, addressing Evgenie and looking at him with an expression of trust and confidence, as though he were applying to a friend for counsel.
Yes, it's a droll situation. I really don't know what advice to give you, replied Evgenie, laughing. Hippolyte gazed steadfastly at him, but said nothing.
To look at him, one might have supposed that he was unconscious at intervals.
Excuse me, said Lebedev, but did you observe the young gentleman's style? I'll go and blow my brains out in the park, says he, so as not to disturb anyone. He thinks he won't disturb anybody if he goes 3 yards away into the park and blows his brains out there.
Gentlemen, began the prince.
No, no, excuse me, most revered prince, Lebedev interrupted excitedly, since you must have observed yourself that this is no joke, and since at least half of your guests must also have concluded that after all that has been said, this youth must blow his brains out for honor's sake. I, as master of this house, and before these witnesses now, call upon you to take steps.
Yes, but what am I to do, Lebedev? What steps am I to take? I am ready.
I'll tell you. In the first place, he must immediately deliver up the pistol which he boasted of, with all its appurtenances. If he does this, I shall consent to his being allowed to spend the night in this house, considering his feeble state of health, and of course conditionally upon his being under proper supervision. But tomorrow he must go elsewhere. Excuse me, prince. Should he refuse to deliver up his weapon, then I shall instantly seize one of his arms and General Ivolgin the other, and we shall hold him until the police arrive and take the matter into their own hands. Mr. Freddy Shenko will kindly fetch them.
At this there was a dreadful noise. Lebedev danced about in his excitement. Ferdishenko prepared to go for the police. Gania frantically insisted that it was all nonsense, for nobody was going to shoot themselves. Evgeny Pavlovich said nothing.
Prince, whispered Hippolyte suddenly, his eyes all ablaze, you don't suppose that I did not foresee all this hatred?
He looked at the prince as though he expected him to reply for a moment.
Enough, he added at length, and addressing the whole company, he cried, it's all my fault, gentlemen. Lebedev, here is the key.
He took out a small bunch of keys. "This one, the last but one. Colia will show you." "Colia, where's Colia?" he cried, looking straight at Colia and not seeing him. "Yes, he'll show you. He packed the bag with me this morning. Take him up. Colia, my bag is upstairs in the prince's study under the table. Here's the key, and in the little case you'll find my pistol and the powder and all. Colia packed it himself, Mr. Lebedev. He'll show you. But it's on condition that tomorrow morning when I leave for Petersburg, you will give me back my pistol, do you hear? I do this for the prince's sake, not yours."
"Capital! That's much better!" cried Lebedev, seizing the key. He made off in haste.
Colia stopped a moment, as though he wished to say something, but Lebedev dragged him away. Hippolyte looked around at the laughing guests. The prince observed that his teeth were chattering as though in a violent attack of ague. "What brutes they are!" he whispered to the prince. Whenever he addressed him, he lowered his voice. "Let him alone. You're too weak now." "Yes, directly. I'll go away directly. I'll—" Suddenly he embraced Muishkin. "Perhaps you think I'm mad, eh?" he asked him, laughing very strangely. "No, but you—" "Directly, directly. Stand still a moment. I wish to look in your eyes. Don't speak. Stand so. Let me look at you. I am bidding farewell to mankind."
He stood so for 10 seconds, gazing at the prince, motionless, deadly pale, his temples wet with perspiration. He held the prince's hand in a strange grip, as though afraid to let him go.
"Hippolyte, Hippolyte, what's the matter with you?" cried Muishkin.
"Directly. There, that's enough. I'll lay down direct. I must drink to the son's health. I wish to. I insist upon it. Let go."
He seized the glass from the table, broke away from the prince, and in a moment had reached the terrace steps. The prince made after him, but it so happened that at this moment Evgeny Pavlovitch stretched out his hand to say good night. The next instant there was a general outcry, and then followed a few moments of indescribable excitement. Reaching the steps, Hippolyte had paused, holding the glass in his left hand while he put his right hand in his coat pocket. Keller insisted afterwards that he had held his right hand in his pocket all the while when he was speaking to the prince, and that he held the latter's shoulder with his left hand only. This circumstance, Keller affirmed, had led him to feel some suspicion from the first. However this may be, Keller ran after Hippolyte, but he was too late. He caught sight of something flashing in Hippolyte's right hand and saw that it was a pistol. He rushed at him, but at that very instant Hippolyte raised the pistol to his temple and pulled the trigger. There followed a sharp metallic click, but no report. When Keller seized the would-be suicide, the latter fell forward into his arms, probably actually believing that he was shot. Keller had hold of the pistol now. Hippolyte was immediately placed in a chair, while the whole company thronged around excitedly, talking and asking each other questions. Every one of them had heard the snap of the trigger, and yet they saw a live and apparently unharmed man before them. Hippolyte himself sat quite unconscious of what was going on, and gazed around with a senseless expression. Lebedev and Colia came rushing up at this moment.
"What is it?"
someone asked breathlessly. "A misfire."
"Perhaps it wasn't loaded," said several voices.
"It's loaded, all right," said Keller, examining the pistol. "But what did it misfire?"
"There was no cap in it," Keller announced.
It would be difficult to describe the pitiable scene that now followed. The first sensation of alarm soon gave place to amusement. Some burst out laughing loud and heartily, and seemed to find a malicious satisfaction in the joke. Poor Hippolyte sobbed hysterically. He wrung his hands. He approached everyone in turn, even Ferdishenko, and took them by both hands and swore solemnly that he had forgotten, absolutely forgotten, accidentally and not on purpose, to put a cap in, and that he had 10 of them at least in his pocket. He pulled them out and showed them to everyone. He protested that he had not liked to put one in beforehand for fear of an accidental explosion in his pocket, that he had thought he would have lots of time to put it in afterwards when required, and that in the heat of the moment he had forgotten all about it. He threw himself upon the prince, then on Evgeny Pavlovitch. He entreated Keller to give him back the pistol, and he'd soon show them all that his honor, but he was dishonored now forever. He fell senseless at last and was carried into the prince's study. Lebedev, now quite sobered down, sent for a doctor, and he and his daughter, with Burdovsky and General Ivolgin, remained by the sick man's couch. When he was carried away unconscious, Keller stood in the middle of the room and made the following declaration to the company in general, in a loud tone of voice with emphasis upon each word. "Gentlemen, if any of you cast any doubt again before me upon Hippolyte's good faith, or hints that the cap was forgotten intentionally, or suggests that this unhappy boy is acting a part before us, I beg to announce that the person so speaking shall account to me for his words." No one replied. The company departed very quickly in a mass. Ptitsin, Gania, and Rogojin went away together. The prince was much astonished that Evgeny Pavlovitch changed his mind and took his departure without the conversation he had requested. "Why, you wished to have a talk with me when the others left," he said. "Quite so," said Evgeny, sitting down suddenly beside him. "But I've changed my mind for the time being. I confess I am too disturbed, and so I think are you. And the matter as to which I wish to consult you is too serious to tackle with one's mind even a little disturbed, too serious for both myself and for you. You see, prince, for once in my life I wish to perform an absolutely honest action, that is, an action with no ulterior motive, and I think I am hardly in a condition to talk of it just at this moment, and well, we'll discuss it another time. Perhaps the matter may gain in clearness if we wait for 2 or 3 days, just the 2 or 3 days which I must spend in Petersburg." Here he rose again from his chair, so that it seemed strange that he should have thought it worthwhile to sit down at all. The prince thought, too, that he looked vexed and annoyed, and not nearly so friendly towards himself as he had been earlier in the night. "I suppose you'll go to the sufferer's bedside now," he added.
"Yes, I'm afraid," began the prince.
"Oh, you needn't fear. He'll live another 6 weeks all right. Very likely he will recover altogether, but I strongly advise you to pack him off tomorrow."
"I think I may have offended him by saying nothing just now. I am afraid he may suspect that I doubted his good faith about shooting himself, you know. What do you think, Evgeny Pavlovitch?"
"Not a bit of it. You are much too good for him. You shouldn't care a hang about what he thinks. I have heard such things before, but never came across till tonight, a man who would actually shoot himself in order to gain a vulgar notoriety, or blow his brains for spite, if he finds that people don't care to pat him on the back for his sanguinary intentions. But what astonishes me more than anything is the fellow's candid confession of weakness. You'd better get rid of him tomorrow, in any case."
"Do you think he'll make another attempt?"
"Oh, no, not he, not now. But you have to be very careful with this sort of gentleman. Crime is too often the last resource of these petty non-entities. This young fellow is quite capable of cutting the throats of 10 people simply for a lark, as he told us in his explanation. I assure you those confounded words of his will not let me sleep. I think you disturb yourself too much." "What an extraordinary person you are, prince! Do you mean to say that you doubt the fact that he is capable of murdering 10 men?
"I daren't say, one way or the other. All this is very strange, but—"
"Well, as you like, just as you like," said Evgeny Pavlovitch irritably. "Only, you are such a plucky fellow. Take care you don't get included among the 10 victims.
"Oh, he's much more likely not to kill anyone at all," said the prince, gazing thoughtfully at Evgeny. The latter laughed disagreeably. "Well, au revoir."
"Did you observe that he willed a copy of his confession to Aglaya Ivanovna?"
"Yes, I did. I'm thinking of it."
"In connection with the 10, eh?" laughed Evgeny as he left the room. An hour later, towards 4 o'clock, the prince went into the park. He had endeavoured to fall asleep, but could not, owing to the painful beating of his heart. He had left things quiet and peaceful. The invalid was fast asleep, and the doctor who had been called in had stated that there was no special danger. Lebedev, Kolya, and Burdovsky were lying down in the sick room, ready to take it in turns to watch. There was nothing to fear, therefore, at home. But the prince's mental perturbation increased every moment. He wandered about the park, looking absently around him, and paused in astonishment when he suddenly found himself in the empty space with the rows of chairs round it near the Vauxhall. The look of the place struck him as dreadful now, so he turned round and went by the path which he had followed with the Epanchins on the way to the band, until he reached the green bench which Aglaya had pointed out for their rendezvous. He sat down on it and suddenly burst into a loud fit of laughter, immediately followed by a feeling of irritation. His disturbance of mind continued. He felt that he must go away somewhere, anywhere. Above his head some little bird sang out of a sudden. He began to peer about for it among the leaves. Suddenly the bird darted out of the tree and away, and instantly he thought of the fly buzzing about in the sun's rays that Hippolyte had talked of, how that it knew its place and was a participator in the universal life while he alone was an outcast. This picture had impressed him at the time, and he meditated upon it now. An old and forgotten memory awoke in his brain and suddenly burst into clearness and light. It was a recollection of Switzerland during the first year of his cure, the very first month. At that time he had been pretty nearly an idiot still. He could not speak properly and had difficulty in understanding when others spoke to him. He climbed the mountainside one sunny morning and wandered long and aimlessly with a certain thought in his brain which would not become clear. Above him was the blazing sky, below the lake. All around was the horizon, clear and infinite. He looked out upon this long and anxiously. He remembered how he had stretched out his arms towards the beautiful boundless blue of the horizon and wept and wept. What had so tormented him was the idea that he was a stranger to all this, that he was outside this glorious festival. What was this universe? What was this grand eternal pageant to which he had yearned from his childhood up, and in which he could never take part? Every morning the same magnificent sun, every morning the same rainbow in the waterfall, every evening the same glow on the snow mountains. Every little fly that buzzed in the sun's rays was the singer in the universal chorus, knew its place and was happy in it. Every blade of grass grew and was happy. Everything knew its path and loved it, went forth with a song and returned with a song. Only he knew nothing, understood nothing, neither men nor words nor any of nature's voices. He was a stranger and an outcast. Oh, he could not speak then these words or express all he felt. He had been tormented dumbly, but now it appeared to him that he must have said these very words even then, and that Hippolyte must have taken his picture of the little fly from his tears and words of that time. He was sure of it, and his heart beat excitedly at the thought, he knew not why. He fell asleep on the bench, but his mental disquiet continued through his slumbers. Just before he dozed off, the idea of Hippolyte murdering 10 men flitted through his brain, and he smiled at the absurdity of such a thought. Around him all was quiet, only the flutter and whisper of the leaves broke the silence, but broke it only to cause it to appear yet more deep and still. He dreamed many dreams as he sat there, and all were full of disquiet, so that he shuddered every moment. At length a woman seemed to approach him. He knew her, oh, he knew her only too well. He could always name her and recognize her anywhere. But strange! She seemed to have quite a different face from hers as he had known it, and he felt a tormenting desire to be able to say she was not the same woman. In the face before him there was such dreadful remorse and horror that he thought she must be a criminal, that she must have just committed some awful crime. Tears were trembling on her white cheek. She beckoned him, but placed her finger on her lip as though to warn him that he must follow her very quietly. His heart froze within him. He couldn't confess her to be a criminal, and yet he felt that something dreadful would happen the next moment, something which would blast his whole life. She seemed to show him something not far off in the park. He rose from his seat in order to follow her when a bright, clear peal of laughter rang out by his side. He felt somebody's hand suddenly on his own, seized it, pressed it hard, and awoke. Before him, Aglaya stood, laughing aloud. End of chapter 7, part 3.
Chapter 8 of part 3 of The Idiot, parts 3 and 4, by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. She laughed, but she was rather angry, too. "He's asleep! You were asleep," she said, with contemptuous surprise. "Is it really you?" muttered the prince, not quite himself as yet, and recognizing her with a start of amazement. "Oh, yes, of course," he added. "This is our rendezvous. I fell asleep here. So I saw. Did no one awake me besides yourself? Was there no one else here? I thought there was another woman. There was another woman here? At last he was wide awake. It was a dream, of course, he said musingly. Strange that I should have a dream like that at such a moment. Sit down. He took her hand and seated her on the bench, then sat down beside her and reflected. Aglaya did not begin the conversation, but contented herself with watching her companion intently. He looked back at her, but at times it was clear that he did not see her and was not thinking of her. Aglaya began to flush up. "Oh, yes," cried the prince, starting. "Hippolyte's suicide." "What, at your house?" she asked, but without much surprise. "He was alive yesterday evening, wasn't he? How could you sleep here after that?" she cried, growing suddenly animated. "Oh, but he didn't kill himself. The pistol didn't go off." Aglaya insisted on hearing the whole story. She hurried the prince along, but interrupted him with all sorts of questions, nearly all of which were irrelevant. Among other things, she seemed greatly interested in every word that Evgeny Pavlovitch had said, and made the prince repeat that part of the story over and over again. "Well, that'll do. We must be quick," she concluded, after hearing all. "We have only an hour here till 8. I must be home by then without fail, so that they may not find out that I came and sat here with you. But I've come on business. I have a great deal to say to you, but you have bowled me over considerably with your news. As to Hippolyte, I think his pistol was bound not to go off. It was more consistent with the whole affair. Are you sure he really wished to blow his brains out, and that there was no humbug about the matter?" "No humbug at all." "Very likely. So he wrote that you were to bring me a copy of his confession, did he? Why didn't you bring it?"
"Why, he didn't die. I'll ask him for it, if you like."
"Bring it by all means. You needn't ask him. He will be delighted, you may be sure, for in all probability he shot at himself simply in order that I might read his confession. Don't laugh at what I say, please, Lef Nikolaevitch, because it may very well be the case."
"I am not laughing. I am convinced myself that that may have been partly the reason."
"You are convinced? You don't really mean to say you think that honestly?" asked Aglaya, extremely surprised. She put her questions very quickly, and talked fast, every now and then forgetting what she had begun to say, and not finishing her sentence. She seemed to be impatient to warn the prince about something or other. She was in a state of unusual excitement, and though she put on a brave and even defiant air, she seemed to be rather alarmed. She was dressed very simply, but this suited her well. She continually trembled and blushed, and she sat on the very edge of the seat. The fact that the prince confirmed her idea about Hippolyte shooting himself that she might read his confession surprised her greatly. "Of course," added the prince, "he wished us all to applaud his conduct, besides yourself."
"How do you mean, applaud?"
"Well, how am I to explain? He was very anxious that we should all come around him and say we were so sorry for him and that we loved him very much and all that, and that we hoped he wouldn't kill himself but remain alive. Very likely he thought more of you than the rest of us, because he mentioned you at such a moment, though perhaps he did not know himself that he had you in his mind's eye."
"I don't understand you. How could he have me in view and not be aware of it himself? And yet, I don't know, perhaps I do. Do you know I have intended to poison myself at least 30 times, ever since I was 13 or so, and to write to my parents before I did it? I used to think how nice it would be to lie in my coffin and have them all weeping over me and saying it was all their fault for being so cruel and all that. What are you smiling at?" she added, knitting her brow. "What do you think of when you go mooning about alone? I suppose you imagine yourself a field marshal and think you have conquered Napoleon."
"Well, I really have thought something of the sort now and then, especially when just dozing off," laughed the prince. "Only it is the Austrians whom I conquer, not Napoleon."
"I don't wish to joke with you, Lef Nikolaevitch. I shall see Hippolyte myself. Tell him so. As for you, I think you are behaving very badly, because it is not right to judge a man's soul as you are judging Hippolyte's. You have no gentleness, but only justice, so you are unjust."
The prince reflected.
"I think you are unfair towards me," he said. "There is nothing wrong in the thoughts I ascribe to Hippolyte. They are only natural. But of course I don't know for certain what he thought. Perhaps he thought nothing, but simply longed to see human faces once more, and to hear human praise and feel human affection. Who knows? Only it all came out wrong, somehow. Some people have luck, and everything comes out right with them. Others have none, and never a thing turns out fortunately." "I suppose you have felt that in your own case," said Aglaya. "Yes, I have," replied the prince, quite unsuspicious of any irony in the remark. "Well, at all events, I shouldn't have fallen asleep here, in your place. It wasn't nice of you, that. I suppose you fall asleep wherever you sit down?" "But I didn't sleep a wink all night. I walked and walked about, and went to where the music was."
"What music?"
"Where they played last night. Then I found this bench and sat down and thought and thought, and at last I fell fast asleep."
"Oh, is that it? That makes a difference, perhaps. What did you go to the bandstand for?"
"I don't know. I—"
"Very well, afterwards. You are always interrupting me. What woman was it you were dreaming about?"
"It was about—you saw her."
"Quite so. I understand. I understand quite well. You are very— Well, how did she appear to you? What did she look like?" "No, I don't want to know anything about her," said Aglaya angrily. "Don't interrupt me."
She paused a moment as though getting breath or trying to master her feeling of annoyance.
"Look here, this is what I called you here for. I wish to make you to ask you to be my friend. What do you stare at me like that for?" she added, almost angrily.
The prince certainly had darted a rather piercing look at her, and now observed that she had begun to blush violently. At such moments, the more Aglaya blushed, the angrier she grew with herself, and this was clearly expressed in her eyes, which flashed like fire. As a rule, she vented her wrath on her unfortunate companion, be it who it might. She was very conscious of her own shyness, and was not nearly so talkative as her sisters for this reason. In fact, at times she was much too quiet. When, therefore, she was bound to talk, especially at such delicate moments as this, she invariably did so with an air of haughty defiance. She always knew beforehand when she was going to blush, long before the blush came.
"Perhaps you do not wish to accept my proposition?" she asked, gazing haughtily at the prince.
"Oh, yes, I do. But it is so unnecessary. I mean, I did not think you need make such a proposition," said the prince, looking confused.
"What did you suppose, then? Why did you think I invited you out here? I suppose you think me a little fool, as they call me at home."
"I didn't know they called you a fool. I certainly don't think you one."
"You don't think me one? Oh, dear me! That's very clever of you. You put it so neatly, too."
"In my opinion, you are far from a fool sometimes. In fact, you are very intelligent. You said a very clever thing just now about my being unjust because I had only justice. I shall remember that and think about it." Aglaya blushed with pleasure. All these changes in her expression came about so naturally and so rapidly. They delighted the prince. He watched her and laughed.
"Listen," she began again. "I have long waited to tell you all this, ever since the time when you sent me that letter. Even before that. Half of what I have to say you heard yesterday. I consider you the most honest and upright of men, more honest and upright than any other man. And if anybody says that your mind is sometimes affected, you know, it is unfair. I always say so and uphold it, because even if your surface mind be a little affected, of course you will not feel angry with me for talking so, I am speaking from a higher point of view, yet your real mind is far better than all theirs put together. Such a mind as they have never even dreamed of, because really, there are two minds, the kind that matters and the kind that doesn't matter. Isn't it so?"
"Maybe, maybe so," said the prince faintly. His heart was beating painfully.
"I knew you would not misunderstand me," she said triumphantly. "Prince S. and Evgeny Pavlovitch and Alexandra don't understand anything about these two kinds of mind, but just fancy, Mama does."
"You are very like Lizabetha Prokofievna."
"What? Surely not," said Aglaya.
Yes, you are indeed.
Thank you. I am glad to be like Mamma, she said thoughtfully. You respect her very much, don't you? She added, quite unconscious of the naiveness of the question.
Very much, and I am so glad that you have realized the fact.
I am very glad, too, because she is often laughed at by people. But listen to the chief point. I have long thought over the matter, and at last I have chosen you. I don't wish people to laugh at me. I don't wish people to think me a little fool. I don't want to be chaffed. I felt all this of a sudden, and I refused Evgeny Pavlovitch flatly, because I am not going to be forever thrown at people's heads to be married. Well, I'll tell you, I wish to run away from home, and I have chosen you to help me.
Run away from home? Cried the prince.
Yes, 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 run away from home, she repeated in a transport of rage. I won't be made to blush every minute by them all. I don't want to blush before Prince S. or Evgeny Pavlovitch or anyone, and therefore I have chosen you. I shall tell you everything, everything, even the most important things of all, whenever I like, and you are to hide nothing from me on your side. I want to speak to at least one person as I would to myself. They have suddenly begun to say that I am waiting for you and in love with you. They began this before you arrived here, and so I didn't show them the letter, and now they all say it, every one of them. I want to be brave and be afraid of nobody. I don't want to go to their balls and things. I want to do good. I have long desired to run away, for I have been kept shut up for 20 years, and they are always trying to marry me off. I wanted to run away when I was 14 years old. I was a little fool then, I know. But now I have worked it all out, and I have waited for you to tell me about foreign countries. I have never seen a single Gothic cathedral. I must go to Rome. I must see all the museums. I must study in Paris. All this last year I have been preparing and reading forbidden books. Alexandra and Adelaida are allowed to read anything they like, but I mayn't. I don't want to quarrel with my sisters, but I told my parents long ago that I wish to change my social position. I have decided to take up teaching, and I count on you because you said you loved children. Can we go in for education together? If not at once, then afterwards. We could do good together. I won't be a general's daughter any more. Tell me, are you a very learned man?
Oh, no, not at all.
Oh, I'm sorry for that. I thought you were. I wonder why I always thought so. But at all events, you'll help me, won't you? Because I've chosen you, you know.
Aglaya Ivanovna, it's absurd.
But I will run away, she cried, and her eyes flashed again with anger. And if you don't agree, I shall go and marry Gavrila Ardalionovitch. I won't be considered a horrible girl and accused of goodness knows what.
Are you out of your mind? Cried the prince, almost starting from his seat. What do they accuse you of? Who accuses you?
At home, everybody, mother, my sisters, Prince S., even that detestable Kolya. If they don't say it, they think it. I told them all so to their faces. I told mother and father and everybody. Mamma was ill all the day after it, and next day father and Alexandra told me that I didn't understand what nonsense I was talking. I informed them that they little knew me. I was not a small child. I understood every word in the language, that I had read a couple of Paul de Kock's novels 2 years since, on purpose, so as to know all about everything. No sooner did Mamma hear me say this than she nearly fainted.
A strange thought passed through the prince's brain. He gazed intently at Aglaya and smiled. He could not believe that this was the same haughty young girl who had once so proudly shown him Gania's letter. He could not understand how that proud and austere beauty could show herself to be such an utter child, a child who probably did not even now understand some words.
"Have you always lived at home, Aglaya Ivanovna?" he asked. "I mean, have you never been to school or college or anything?"
"No, never, nowhere. I've been at home all my life, corked up in a bottle, and they expect me to be married straight out of it. What are you laughing at again? I observe that you, too, have taken to laughing at me, and range yourself on their side against me," she added, frowning angrily. "Don't irritate me. I'm bad enough without that. I don't know what I'm doing sometimes. I am persuaded that you came here today in the full belief that I am in love with you, and that I arranged this meeting because of that," she cried with annoyance. "I admit I was afraid that that was the case yesterday," blundered the prince. He was rather confused. "But today I am quite convinced that—" "How?" cried Aglaya, and her lower lip trembled violently. "You were afraid that I—you dared to think that I— Good gracious! You suspected, perhaps, that I sent for you to come here in order to catch you in a trap, so that they should find us here together and make you marry me." "Aglaya Ivanovna, aren't you ashamed of saying such a thing? How could such a horrible idea enter your sweet, innocent heart? I am certain you don't believe a word of what you say, and probably you don't even know what you are talking about." Aglaya sat with her eyes on the ground. She seemed to have alarmed even herself by what she had said. "No, I'm not. I'm not a bit ashamed," she murmured. "And how do you know my heart is innocent? And how dared you send me a love letter that time?" "Love letter? My letter a love letter? That letter was the most respectful of letters. It went straight from my heart at what was perhaps the most painful moment of my life. I thought of you at the time as a kind of light. Well, very well, very well," she said, but quite in a different tone. She was remorseful now, and bent forward to touch his shoulder, though still trying not to look him in the face, as if the more persuasively, to beg him not to be angry with her. "Very well," she continued, looking thoroughly ashamed of herself. "I feel that I said a very foolish thing. I only did it just to try you. Take it as unsaid, and if I offended you, forgive me. Don't look straight at me like that. Please, turn your head away. You called it a horrible idea. I only said it to shock you. Very often I am myself afraid of saying what I intend to say, and out it comes all the same. You have just told me that you wrote that letter at the most painful moment of your life. I know what moment that was," she added softly, looking at the ground again. "Oh, if you could know all!" "I do know all," she cried, with another burst of indignation. "You were living in the same house as that horrible woman with whom you ran away." She did not blush as she said this. On the contrary, she grew pale and started from her seat, apparently oblivious of what she did, and immediately sat down again. Her lip continued to tremble for a long time. There was silence for a moment. The prince was taken aback by the suddenness of this last reply and did not know to what he should attribute it. "I don't love you a bit," she said suddenly, just as though the words had exploded from her mouth. The prince did not answer, and there was silence again. "I love Gavrila Ardalionovitch," she said quickly, but hardly audibly, and with her head bent lower than ever. "That is not true," said the prince, in an equally low voice. "What? I tell stories, do I? It is true. I gave him my promise a couple of days ago on this very seat." The prince was startled and reflected for a moment. "It is not true," he repeated decidedly. "You have just invented it. You are wonderfully polite. You know he is greatly improved. He loves me better than his life. He let his hand burn before my very eyes in order to prove to me that he loved me better than his life."
"He burned his hand?"
"Yes, believe it or not. It's all the same to me." The prince sat silent once more. Aglaya did not seem to be joking. She was too angry for that. "What, he brought a candle with him to this place? That is, if the episode happened here. Otherwise I can't." "Yes, a candle. What's there improbable about that?" "A whole one, and in a candlestick." "Yes, no half a candle. An end, you know. No, it was a whole candle. It's all the same. Be quiet, can't you? He brought a box of matches, too, if you like, and then lighted the candle and held his finger in it for half an hour and more. There, can't that be?"
"I saw him yesterday, and his fingers were all right."
Aglaya suddenly burst out laughing, as simply as a child. "Do you know why I've just told you these lies?" She appealed to the prince of a sudden, with the most childlike candor, and with the laugh still trembling on her lips. "Because when one tells a lie, if one insists on something unusual and eccentric, something too out of the way, for anything, you know, the more impossible the thing is, the more plausible does the lie sound. I've noticed this. but I managed it badly. I didn't know how to work it."
She suddenly frowned again at this point, as though at some sudden unpleasant recollection.
"If," she began, looking seriously and even sadly at him, "if when I read you all that about the poor knight, I wished to praise you for one thing, I also wished to show you that I knew all, and did not approve of your conduct. You are very unfair to me, and to that unfortunate woman of whom you spoke just now in such dreadful terms, Aglaya.
Because I know all, and that is why I speak so. I know very well how you, half a year since, offered her your hand before everybody. Don't interrupt me. You see, I am merely stating facts without any comment upon them. After that, she ran away with Rogojin. Then you lived with her at some village or town, and she ran away from you."
Aglaya blushed dreadfully.
"Then she returned to Rogojin again, who loves her like a madman. Then you, like a wise man as you are, came back here after her, as soon as ever you heard that she had returned to Petersburg. Yesterday evening you sprang forward to protect her, and just now you dreamed about her. You see, I know all. You did come back here for her, now didn't you?"
"Yes, for her," said the prince, softly and sadly, and bending his head down, quite unconscious of the fact that Aglaya was gazing at him with eyes which burned like live coals. "I came to find out something. I don't believe in her future happiness as Rogojin's wife, although, in a word, I did not know how to help her or what to do for her. But I came on the chance." He glanced at Aglaya, who was listening with a look of hatred on her face.
"If you came without knowing why, I suppose you love her very much indeed," she said at last.
"No," said the prince, "no, I do not love her. Oh, if you only knew with what horror I recall the time I spent with her." A shudder seemed to sweep over his whole body at the recollection.
"Tell me about it," said Aglaya.
"There is nothing which you might not hear. Why I should wish to tell you, and only you, this experience of mine, I really cannot say. Perhaps it really is because I love you very much. This unhappy woman is persuaded that she is the most hopeless, fallen creature in the world. Oh, do not condemn her. Do not cast stones at her. She has suffered too much already in the consciousness of her own undeserved shame. And she is not guilty. Oh, God! Every moment she bemoans and bewails herself and cries out that she does not admit any guilt, that she is the victim of circumstances, the victim of a wicked libertine. But whatever she may say, remember that she does not believe it herself. Remember that she will believe nothing but that she is a guilty creature. When I tried to rid her soul of this gloomy fallacy, she suffered so terribly that my heart will never be quite at peace so long as I can remember that dreadful time. Do you know why she left me? Simply to prove to me what is not true, that she is base. But the worst of it is, she did not realize herself that that was all she wanted to prove by her departure. She went away in response to some inner prompting to do something disgraceful, in order that she might say to herself, 'There, you've done a new act of shame, you degraded creature!' Oh, Aglaya, perhaps you cannot understand all this. Try to realize that in the perpetual admission of guilt she probably finds some dreadful, unnatural satisfaction, as though she were revenging herself upon someone. Now and then I was able to persuade her almost to see light around her again, but she would soon fall once more into her old tormenting delusions, and would go so far as to reproach me for placing myself on a pedestal above her. I never had an idea of such a thing, and informed me, in reply to my proposal of marriage, that she did not want condescending sympathy or help from anybody. You saw her last night. You don't suppose she can be happy among such people as those. You cannot suppose that such society is fit for her. You have no idea how well-educated she is, and what an intellect she has. She astonished me sometimes."
"And you preached her sermons there, did you?"
"Oh, no," continued the prince thoughtfully, not noticing Aglaya's mocking tone. "I was almost always silent there. I often wished to speak, but I really did not know what to say. In some cases it is best to say nothing, I think. I loved her, yes, I loved her very much indeed. But afterwards she guessed all."
"What did she guess?"
"That I only pitied her, and loved her no longer."
"How do you know that? How do you know that she is not really in love with that rich cad, the man she eloped with?"
Oh, no. I know she only laughs at him. She has made a fool of him all along.
Has she never laughed at you?
No. In anger, perhaps. Oh, yes. She reproached me dreadfully in anger, and suffered herself, too. But afterwards, oh, don't remind me. Don't remind me of that. He hid his face in his hands.
Are you aware that she writes to me almost every day?
So that is true, is it? Cried the prince, greatly agitated. I had heard a report of it, but would not believe it.
Whom did you hear it from? Asked Aglaya, alarmed.
Rogojin said something about it yesterday, but nothing definite.
Yesterday, morning or evening, before the music or after?
After. It was about 12 o'clock.
Ah, well, if it was Rogojin. But do you know what she writes to me about?
I should not be surprised by anything. She is mad.
There are the letters.
Aglaya took three letters out of her pocket and threw them down before the prince.
For a whole week she has been entreating and worrying and persuading me to marry you. She is clever, though she may be mad, much cleverer than I am, as you say. Well, she writes that she is in love with me herself, and tries to see me every day, if only from a distance. She writes that you love me, and that she has long known it, and seen it, and that you and she talked about me there. She wishes to see you happy, and she says that she is certain only I can assure you the happiness you deserve. She writes such strange, wild letters. I haven't shown them to anyone. Now, do you know what all this means? Can you guess anything?
It is madness. It is merely another proof of her insanity, said the prince, and his lips trembled.
You are crying, aren't you?
No, Aglaya. No, I'm not crying. The prince looked at her.
Well, what am I to do? What do you advise me? I cannot go on receiving these letters, you know.
Oh, let her alone. I entreat you, cried the prince. What can you do in this dark, gloomy mystery? Let her alone, and I'll use all my power to prevent her writing you any more letters.
If so, you are a heartless man, cried Aglaya, as if you can't see that it is not myself she loves, but you, you, and only you. Surely you have not remarked everything else in her, and only not this? Do you know what these letters mean? They mean jealousy, sir, nothing but pure jealousy. Do you think she will ever really marry this Rogojin, as she says here she will? She would take her own life the day after you and I were married.
The prince shuddered. His heart seemed to freeze within him. He gazed at Aglaya in wonderment. It was difficult for him to realize that this child was also a woman.
God knows, Aglaya, that to restore her peace of mind and make her happy I would willingly give up my life. But I cannot love her, and she knows that.
Oh, make a sacrifice of yourself. That sort of thing becomes you well, you know. Why not do it? And don't call me Aglaya. You have done it several times lately. You are bound. It is your duty to raise her. You must go off somewhere again to soothe and pacify her. Why, you love her, you know.
I cannot sacrifice myself so, though I admit I did wish to do so once. Who knows, perhaps I still wish to. But I know for certain that if she married me, it would be her ruin. I know this, and therefore I leave her alone. I ought to go to see her today. Now I shall probably not go. She is proud. She would never forgive me the nature of the love I bear her, and we should both be ruined. This may be unnatural, I don't know, but everything seems unnatural. You say she loves me as if this were love, as if she could love me after what I have been through. No, no, it is not love.
How pale you have grown, cried Aglaya in alarm.
Oh, it's nothing. I haven't slept, that's all, and I'm rather tired.
We certainly did talk about you, Aglaya.
Oh, indeed, it is true, then. You could actually talk about me with her, and how could you have been fond of me when you had only seen me once?
I don't know. Perhaps it was that I seemed to come upon light in the midst of my gloom. I told you the truth when I said I did not know why I thought of you before all others. Of course it was all a sort of dream, a dream amidst the horrors of reality. Afterwards I began to work. I did not intend to come back here for 2 or 3 years.
Then you came for her sake?
Aglaya's voice trembled. Yes, I came for her sake. There was a moment or two of gloomy silence. Aglaya rose from her seat.
"If you say," she began, in shaky tones, "if you say that this woman of yours is mad, at all events I have nothing to do with her insane fancies. Kindly take these three letters, Lef Nikolaevitch, and throw them back to her, from me. And if she dares," cried Aglaya suddenly, much louder than before, "if she dares so much as write me one word again, tell her I shall tell my father, and that she shall be taken to a lunatic asylum." The prince jumped up in alarm at Aglaya's sudden wrath, and a mist seemed to come before his eyes. "You cannot really feel like that. You don't mean what you say. It is not true," he murmured. "It is true, it is true," cried Aglaya, almost beside herself with rage. "What's true? What's all this? What's true?" said an alarmed voice just beside them. Before them stood Lizaveta Prokofievna. "Why, it's true that I'm going to marry Gavrila Adralionovitch, that I love him and intend to elope with him tomorrow," cried Aglaya, turning upon her mother. "Do you hear? Is your curiosity satisfied? Are you pleased with what you have heard?" Aglaya rushed away homewards with these words. "Hum! Well, you are not going away just yet, my friend, at all events," said Lizaveta, stopping the prince. "Kindly step home with me and let me have a little explanation of the mystery. Nice goings-on, these. I haven't slept a wink all night as it is." The prince followed her. End of part 3, chapter 8.
Chapter 9, part 3 of The Idiot by Fyodor Dostoevsky, translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Ali Mekki. Chapter 9. Arrived at their house, Lizaveta Prokofievna paused in this first room. She could go no further and subsided onto a couch, quite exhausted, too feeble to remember so much as to ask the prince to take a seat. This was a large reception room, full of flowers, and with a glass door leading into the garden. Alexandra and Adelaida came in almost immediately and looked inquiringly at the prince and their mother. The girls generally rose at about 9 in the morning in the country. Aglaya of late had been in the habit of getting up rather earlier and having a walk in the garden, but not at 7 o'clock, but about 8 or a little later was her usual time. Lizaveta Prokofievna, who really had not slept all night, rose at about 8 on purpose to meet Aglaya in the garden and walk with her, but she could not find her either in the garden or in her own room. This agitated the old lady considerably, and she awoke her other daughters. Next, she learned from the maid that Aglaya had gone into the park before 7 o'clock. The sisters made a joke of Aglaya's last freak and told their mother that if she went into the park to look for her, Aglaya would probably be very angry with her, and that she was pretty sure to be sitting reading on the garden bench that she had talked of 2 or 3 days since, and about which she had nearly quarrelled with Prince S., who did not see anything particularly lovely in it. Arrived at the rendezvous of the prince and her daughter, and hearing the strange words of the latter, Lizaveta Prokofievna had been dreadfully alarmed for many reasons. However, now that she had dragged the prince home with her, she began to feel a little frightened at what she had undertaken. Why should not Aglaya meet the prince in the park and have a talk with him, even if such meeting should be by appointment? "Don't suppose, prince," she began, bracing herself up for the effort, "don't suppose that I have brought you here to ask questions. After last night, I assure you, I am not so exceedingly anxious to see you at all. I could have postponed the pleasure for a long while," she paused, "but at the same time, you would be very glad to know how I happened to meet Aglaya Ivanovna this morning." The prince finished her speech for her with the utmost composure. "Well, what then? Supposing I should like to know," cried Lizaveta Prokofievna, blushing. "I'm sure I'm not afraid of plain speaking. I'm not offending anyone, and never wish to, and, pardon me, it is not offence to wish to know this. You are her mother. We met at the garden bench this morning, punctual at 7 o'clock, according to an agreement made by Aglaya Ivanovna with myself yesterday. She said that she wished to see me and speak to me about something important. We met and conversed for an hour about matters concerning Aglaya Ivanovna herself, and that's all." "Of course it is all, my friend. I don't doubt you for a moment," said Lizaveta Prokofievna with dignity. "Well done, prince! Capital!" cried Aglaya, who entered the room at this moment. "Thank you for assuring that I would not demean myself with lies. Come, that is enough, mamma, or do you intend to put any more questions? You know I have never needed to blush before you, up to this day, though perhaps you would have been glad enough to make me," said Lizabetha Prokofievna with majesty. "Good-bye, prince. Forgive me for bothering you. I trust you will rest assured of my unaltered esteem for you." The prince made his bow and retired at once. Alexandra and Adelaida smiled and whispered to each other while Lizabetha Prokofievna glared severely at them. "We are only laughing at the prince's beautiful bows, mamma. Sometimes he bows just like a meal sack, but today he was like Evgenie Pavlovitch. It is the heart which is the best teacher of refinement and dignity, not dancing master," said her mother sententiously, and departed upstairs to her own room, not so much as glancing at Aglaya. When the prince reached home about 9 o'clock, he found Vera Lebedev and the maid on the veranda. They were both busy trying to tidy up the place after last night's disorderly party. "Thank goodness, we've just managed to finish before you came in," said Vera joyfully. "Good morning. My heart whirls so. I didn't sleep all night. I should like to have a nap now." "Here, on the veranda? Very well. I'll tell them not to come and wake you. Papa has gone out somewhere." The servant left the room. Vera was about to follow her, but returned and approached the prince with a preoccupied air. "Prince," she said, "have pity on that poor boy. Don't turn him out today." "Not for the world. He shall do as he likes. He won't do any harm now, and don't be too severe with him." "Oh dear, no, why?" And you won't laugh at him? That's the chief thing." "Oh no, never. How foolish am I to speak of such things to a man like you," said Vera, blushing. "Though you do look tired," she added, half turning away, "your eyes are so splendid at this moment, so full of happiness." "Really," said the prince gleefully, and he laughed in delight. But Vera, simple-minded little girl that she was, just like a boy, in fact, here became dreadfully confused of a sudden, and ran hastily out of the room, laughing and blushing. "What a dear little thing she is," thought the prince, and immediately forgot all about her. He walked to the far end of the veranda, where the sofa stood with a table in front of it. Here he sat down and covered his face with his hands, and so remained for 10 minutes. Suddenly he put his hand in his coat pocket and hurriedly produced 3 letters. But the door opened again, and came out Colia. The prince actually felt glad that he had been interrupted, and might return the letters to his pocket. He was glad of the respite. "Well," said Colia, plunging in medias res, as he always did, "here's a go. What do you think about Hippolyte now? Don't respect him any longer, eh?" "Why not? But look here, Colia, I'm tired. Besides, the subject is too melancholy to begin upon again. How is he, though?"
"Asleep. He'll sleep for a couple of hours yet. I quite understand. You haven't slept. You walked about the park, I know. Agitation, excitement, all that sort of thing. Quite natural, too."
"How do you know I walked in the park and didn't sleep at home?"
"Vera just told me. She tried to persuade me not to come, but I couldn't help myself just for 1 minute. I have been having my turn at the bedside for the last 2 hours. Kostya Lebedev is there now. Burdovsky has gone. Now lie down, prince. Make yourself comfortable and sleep well. I'm awfully impressed, you know."
"Naturally, all this."
No, I mean with the explanation, especially that part of it where he talks about providence and a future life. There is a gigantic thought there."
The prince gazed affectionately at Colia, who, of course, had come in solely for the purpose of talking about this gigantic thought.
"But it may not be one particular thought only. It is the general circumstances of the case. If Voltaire had written this now, or Rousseau, I should have just read it and thought it remarkable, but should not have been so impressed by it. But a man who knows for certain that he has about 10 minutes to live and can talk like that, why, it's pride, that is. It is really a most extraordinary exalted assertion of personal dignity. It's defiant. What a gigantic strength of will, eh? And to accuse a fellow like that of not putting in the cap on purpose, it's base and mean. You know, he deceived us last night, the cunning rascal. I never packed his bag for him. I never saw a pistol. He packed it himself, but he put off my guard like that, you see. Vera says you are going to let him stay on. I swear there's no danger, especially as we are always with him. Who was by him at night?
I, and Burdovsky, and Kostya Lebedev. Keller stayed a little while, and then went over to Lebedev's to sleep. Ferdishenko slept at Lebedev's too, but he went away at 7 o'clock. My father is always at Lebedev's, but he has gone out now. I dare say Lebedev will be coming in here directly. He has been looking for you. I don't know what he wants. Shall we let him in or not, if you're asleep? I'm going to have a nap too. By the by, such a curious thing happened. Burdovsky awoke me at 7, and I met my father just outside the room, so drunk he didn't even know me. He stood before me like a dog, and when he recovered himself, asked hurriedly how Hippolyte was. Yes, then I told him, that's all very well, but I really came to warn you that you must be very careful what you say before Ferdishenko. Do you follow me, Prince?
Yes, is it really so? However, it's all the same to us, of course.
Of course it is. We're not the secret society, and that being the case, it is all the more curious that the general should have been on his way to wake me up in order to tell me this.
Ferdishenko has gone, you say?
Yes, he went at 7 o'clock. He came into the room on his way out. I was watching just then. He said he was going to spend the rest of the night at the Wilkins. There's a tipsy fellow, a friend of his of that name. Well, I'm off. Oh, here's Lebedev himself. The prince wants to go to sleep, Lukian Timofeyevich, so you may just go away again.
One dear moment, my dear prince, just one. I must absolutely speak to you about something which is most grave, said Lebedev mysteriously and solemnly, entering the room with a bow and looking extremely important. He had but just returned and carried his hat in his hand. He looked preoccupied and most unusually dignified. The prince begged him to take a chair. I hear you have called twice. I suppose you're still worried about yesterday's affair.
What, the little boy, you mean? Oh, dear, no. Yesterday my ideas were a little, well, mixed. Today, I assure you, I shall not oppose in the slightest degree any suggestion it may please you to make.
What's up with you this morning, Lebedev? You look so important and dignified, and you choose your words so carefully, said the prince, smiling.
Nikolai Ardalionovitch, said Lebedev in the most amiable tone of voice, addressing the boy, as I have a communication to make to the prince which concerns only myself.
Oh, of course, not my affair, all right, said Kolya, and away he went.
I love that boy for his perception, said Lebedev, looking after him. My dear prince, he continued, I have a terrible misfortune, either last night or early this morning. I cannot tell the exact time.
What is it?
I have lost 400 rubles out of my side pocket. They're gone, said Lebedev with a sour smile.
You've lost 400 rubles? Ooh, I'm sorry for that.
Yes, it is serious for a poor man who lives by his toil.
Of course, of course. How was it?
Old wine is to blame, of course. I confess to you, prince, as I would to Providence itself. Yesterday I received 400 rubles from a debtor at about 5 in the afternoon and came down here by train. I had my purse in my pocket. When I changed, I put the money into the pocket of my plain clothes, intending to keep it by me, as I expected to have an applicant for it in the evening.
It's true, then, Lebedev, that you advertised to lend money on gold or silver articles?
Yes, through an agent. My own name doesn't appear. I have a large family, you see, and at a small percentage.
Quite so, quite so. I only asked for information. Excuse the question. Go on.
Well, meanwhile, that sick boy was brought here, and those guests came in, and we had tea, and we made merry to my ruin. Hearing of your birthday afterwards, and excited with the circumstances of the evening, I ran upstairs and changed my plain clothes once more for my uniform. Civil service clerks in Russia wear uniform. You must have noticed that I had my uniform on all evening. Well, I forgot the money in the pocket of my old coat. You know, when God will ruin a man, he first of all bereaves him of his senses. And it was only this morning at 7:30 that I woke up and grabbed at my coat first thing. The pocket was empty, the purse gone, and not a trace to be found.
Dear me, this is very unpleasant.
Unpleasant, indeed it is. You have found a very appropriate expression, said Lebedev politely, but with sarcasm. But what's to be done? It's a serious matter, said the prince thoughtfully.
Don't you think you might have dropped it out of your pocket whilst intoxicated?
Certainly. Anything is possible when one is intoxicated, as you neatly express it, prince. But consider, if I, intoxicated or not, dropped an object out of my pocket onto the ground, that object ought to remain on the ground. Where is the object then?
Didn't you put it away in some drawer, perhaps?
I've looked everywhere and turned out everything.
I confess, this disturbs me a good deal. Someone must have picked it up then,
or taken it out of my pocket. Two alternatives.
It is very distressing, because who? That's the question.
Most undoubtedly, your excellent prince, you have hit it, and that is the very question. How wonderfully you express the exact situation in a few words. Come, come, Lebedev, no sarcasm, it's serious. Sarcasm? Cried Lebedev, wringing his hands. All right, I'm not angry, I'm only put out about this. Whom do you suspect? That is a very difficult and complicated question. I cannot suspect the servant, for she was in the kitchen the whole evening, nor do I suspect any of my children. I should think not. Go on. Then it must be one of the guests. Is such a thing possible? Absolutely and utterly impossible. And yet, so it must be. But one thing I am sure of, if it be a theft, it was committed not in the evening when we are all together, but either at night or early in the morning, therefore, by one of those who slept here. Burdovsky and Kolya except, of course, they did not even come into my room. Yes, or even if they had, who did you sleep with? Four of us, including myself, in two rooms. The general, myself, Keller, and Ferdishenko. One of us four it must have been. I don't suspect myself, though such cases have been known. Oh, do go on, Lebedev, don't drag it out so. Well, there are three left, and Keller, firstly. He's a drunkard, to begin with, and a liberal, in the sense of other people's pockets. Otherwise, with more of the ancient knight about him than of the modern liberal. He was the sick man at first, but came over afterwards because there was no place to lie down in the room, and the floor was so hard. You suspect him? I did suspect him. When I woke up at 7:30 and tore my hair in despair for my loss and carelessness, I woke the general, who was sleeping the sleep of innocence near me. Taking into consideration the sudden disappearance of Ferdishenko, which was suspicious in itself, we decided to search Keller, who was lying there sleeping like a top. Well, we searched his clothes thoroughly, and not a farthing did we find. In fact, his pockets all had holes in them. We found a dirty handkerchief and a love letter from some scullery maid. The general decided that he was innocent. We woke him for further inquiries, and had the greatest difficulty in making him understand what was up. He opened his mouth and started. He looked so stupid, so absurdly innocent. It wasn't Keller. I'm so glad, said the prince joyfully. I was so afraid. Afraid? Then you had some grounds for supposing he might be the culprit? Said Lebedev, frowning. No, no, not a bit. It was foolish of me to say I was afraid. Don't repeat it, please, Lebedev. Don't tell anyone I said that. My dear prince, your words lie in the lowest depth of my heart. It is their tomb, said Lebedev solemnly, pressing his hat to the region of his heart. Thanks. Very well. Then I suppose it's Ferdishenko, that is, I mean, you suspect Ferdishenko? Whom else? Said Lebedev softly, gazing intently into the prince's face. Of course, quite so. Whom else? But what are the proofs? We have evidence. In the first place, his mysterious disappearance at 7 o'clock or even earlier. I know, Kolya told me that he had said he was off to, I forgot the name, some friend of his, to finish the night. Then Kolya has spoken to you already. Not about the theft. He does not know of it. I have kept it secret. Well, very well. Ferdishenko went off to Wilkins. That's not so curious in itself, but here the evidence opens out further. He left his address, you see, when he went. Now, prince, consider, why did he leave his address? Do you suppose he went out of his way to tell Kolya that he had gone to Wilkins? Who cared to know that he was going to Wilkins? No, no, prince. This is finesse. Thieves' finesse. This is as good as saying, there, how can I be a thief when I leave my address? I'm not concealing my movements as a thief would. Do you understand, prince? Yes, but that's not enough. Second proof. The scent turns out to be false, and the address given is a sham, and an hour later, that is at about 8, I went to Wilkins myself, and there was no trace of Ferdishenko. The maid did tell me, certainly at an hour or so, since someone had been hammering at the door and smashed the bell. She said she would not open the door because she didn't want to wake her master. Probably she was too lazy to get up herself. Such phenomena are met with occasionally. But is that all your evidence? It's not enough. Well, prince, whom are we to suspect, then? Consider, said Lebedev, with almost servile amiability, smiling at the prince. There was a look of cunning in his eyes, however. You should search your room and all the cupboards again, said the prince, after a moment or two of silent reflection. But I have done so, my dear prince, said Lebedev more sweetly than ever. Why must you need go up and change your coat like that? Asked the prince, banging the table with his fist in annoyance. Oh, don't be so worried about my account, prince. I assure you, I am not worth it. At least, not I alone. But I see you are suffering on behalf of the criminal, too, for wretched Ferdishenko, in fact. Of course, you have given me a disagreeable enough thing to think about, said the prince irritably. But what are you going to do, since you are so sure it was Ferdishenko?
But who else could it be, my very dear prince?" repeated Lebedev, as sweet as sugar again. "If you don't wish me to suspect Mr. Burdovsky." "Of course not."
"Nor the general?"
"Nonsense," said the prince, angrily turning round upon him. "Quite so, nonsense. Ha, ha, ha. Dear me, he did amuse me, did the general. We went off on the hot scent to Wilkins together, you know. But I must first observe that the general was even more thunderstruck than I myself this morning when I awoke him after discovering the theft. So much so that his face changed. He grew red and then pale and at length flew into paroxysm. Of such noble wrath that I assure you I was quite surprised. He is a most generous-hearted man. He tells lies by the thousands, I know, but it's merely a weakness. He is a man of the highest feelings, a simple-minded man too, and a man who carries the conviction of innocence in his very appearance. I love that man. Sir, I may have told you so before. It is a weakness of mine. Well, he suddenly stopped in the middle of the road, opened out his coat, and bared his chest. 'Search me,' he says. 'You searched Keller, why don't you search me too? It's only fair,' says he. And all the while, his legs and hands were trembling with anger, and he as white as sheet all over. I said to him, 'Nonsense, General. If anybody but yourself had said it to me, I'd have taken my head, my own head, and put it on a large dish and carried it round to anyone who suspected you. And I should have said, "There, you see that head? It's my head, and I'll go bail with that head for him. Yes, and walk through the fire for him, too." "There," says I, "that's how I'd answer for you, General." Then he embraced me in the middle of the street and hugged me so tight, crying over me all the while, and Zarakov fit to choke. "You're the one friend left to me amid all my misfortunes," says he. Oh, he's a man of sentiment, that. He went on to tell me a story of how he had been accused or suspected of stealing 500,000 rubles once as a young man, and how the very next day he had rushed into a burning blazing house and saved the very count who suspected him and Nina Alexandrovna, who was then a young girl, from a fiery death. The count embraced him, and that was how he came to marry Nina Alexandrovna, he said. As for the money, it was found among the ruins the next day in an English iron box with a secret lock. It had got under the floor somehow, and if it had not been for the fire, you would never have been found. The whole thing is, of course, an absolute fabrication, though. When he spoke of Nina Alexandrovna, he wept. She's a grand woman, is Nina Alexandrovna, though she is very angry with me. Are you acquainted with her? Well, hardly at all. I wish I were, if only for the sake of justifying myself in her eyes. Nina Alexandrovna has a grudge against me for, as she thinks, encouraging her husband in drinking. Whereas in reality, I not only do not encourage him, but I actually keep him out of harm's way and out of bad company. Besides, he's my friend, prince, so that I shall not lose sight of him again. Where he goes, I go. He's quite given up visiting the captain's widow, though sometimes he thinks sadly of her, especially in the morning when he's putting on his boots. I don't know why it's at that time, but he has no money, and it's no use his going to see her without. Has he borrowed any money from you, prince?"
"No, he hasn't."
"Ha! He's ashamed to. He meant to ask you. I know, for he said so. I suppose he thinks that, as you gave him some once, you remember, you would probably refuse if he asked you again. Do you ever give him money?"
"Prince, money? Why, I would give that man not only my money, but my very life if he wanted it."
"Well, perhaps that's an exaggeration. Not life, we'll say, but some illness, a boil or a bad cough or anything of that sort. I would stand with pleasure for his sake, for I consider him a great man fallen. Money, indeed."
"Then you do give him money?"
"No, I've never given him money. He knows well that I will never give him any, because I'm anxious to keep him out of intemperate ways. He's going to town with me now, for you must know I'm off to Petersburg after Ferdishenko, while the scent is hot. I'm certain he's there. I shall let the general go one way while I go the other. We have so arranged matters in order to pop out upon Ferdishenko, you see, from different sides. But I am going to follow that naughty old general and catch him. I know where, at a certain widow's house, for I think it will be a good lesson to put him to shame by catching him with the widow." "Oh, Lebedev, don't make any scandal about it," said the prince, much agitated and speaking in a low voice.
"Not for the world, not for the world. I merely wish to make him ashamed of himself. Oh, prince, great though this misfortune be to myself, I cannot help thinking of his morals.
I have a great favour to ask you, esteemed prince. I confess that it is the chief object of my visit.
You know the Ivolgins, you have even lived in their house, so if you would lend me your help, honored prince, in the general's own interest and for his good." Lebedev clasped his hand in supplication. "What help do you want from me? May it be certain that I am most anxious to understand you, Lebedev." "I felt sure of that, or I should not have come to you." "We might manage it with the help of Nina Alexandrovna, so that he might be closely watched in his own house. Unfortunately, I'm not on terms otherwise, but Nikolai Ardalionovitch, who adores you with all his youthful soul, might help too." "No, heaven forbid that we should bring Nina Alexandrovna into this business, or Kolya either. But perhaps I have not yet quite understood you, Lebedev." Lebedev made an impatient movement. "But there is nothing to understand. Sympathy and tenderness, that is all our poor invalid requires. You will permit me to consider him invalid?" "Yes, it shows delicacy and intelligence on your part." "I will explain my idea by a practical example to make it clearer. You know the sort of man he is. At present, his only failing is that he is crazy about the captain's widow, and he cannot go to her without money, and I mean to catch him at her house today, for his own good. But supposing it was not only the widow, but that he had committed a real crime, or at least some very dishonorable action, of which he is, of course, incapable. I repeat that even in that case, if he were treated with what I may call generous tenderness, one could get at the whole truth, for he is very soft-hearted. Believe me, he would betray himself before 5 days were out. He would burst into tears and make a clean breast of the matter, especially if managed with tact. And if you and his family watched his every step, so to speak, oh, my dear prince," Lebedev added almost empathically, "I do not positively assert that he has... I am ready, as the saying is, to shed my last drop of blood for him this instant, but you will admit that debauchery, drunkenness, and the captain's widow, all these together may lead him very far." "I am, of course, quite ready to add my efforts to yours in such a case," said the prince, rising. "But I confess, Lebedev, that I am terribly perplexed. Tell me, do you still think plainly? Do you say yourself that you suspected, that you suspect Mr. Ferdishenko?" Lebedev clasped his hands once more. "Why, who else could I possibly suspect? Who else most outspoken, prince?" he replied with an anxious smile. Mishkin frowned and rose from his seat. "You see, Lebedev, a mistake here would be a dreadful thing. This Ferdishenko, I would not say a word against him, of course. But who knows, perhaps it really was he. I mean, he really does seem to be more likely a man than any other." Lebedev strained his eyes and ears to take in what the prince was saying. The latter was frowning more and more, and walking excitedly up and down, trying not to look at Lebedev. "You see, I was given to understand that Ferdishenko was that sort of man, that one can't say everything before him. One has to take care not to say too much, you understand? I have to say this to prove that he really is, so to speak, more likely to have done this than anyone else.
You understand?
The important thing is not to make a mistake." "And who told you this about Ferdishenko?" "Oh, I was told. Of course, I don't believe it altogether. I'm very sorry I should have had to say this, because I assure you I don't believe it myself. It is all nonsense, of course. It was stupid of me to say anything about it."
"You see, it is very important, it is most important to know where you got this report from," said Lebedev excitedly. He had risen from his seat and was trying to keep step with the prince, running after him up and down.
"Because, look here, prince, I don't mind telling you now that as we were going along to Wilkins this morning, after telling me that you know about the fire and saving the account and all that, the general was pleased to drop certain hints to the same effect about Ferdishenko, but so vaguely and clumsily that I thought better to put a few questions to him on the matter, with the result that I found the whole thing was an invention of his Excellency's own mind. Of course, he only lies with the best intentions, still, he lies. But such being the case, where could you have heard the same report? It was the inspiration of the moment with him, you understand. So, who could have told you? It is an important question, you see. It was Kolya told me, and his father told him about 6 this morning. They met at the threshold when Kolya was leaving the room for something or other." The prince told Lebedev all that Kolya had made known to himself in detail.
"There now, that's what we call a scent," said Lebedev, rubbing his hands and laughing silently.
I thought it must be so easy. The general interrupted his innocent slumbers at 6 o'clock in order to go and wake his beloved son and warn him of the dreadful danger of companionship with Ferdishenko. Dear me, what a dreadful dangerous man Ferdishenko must be, and what touching paternal solicitude on the part of his excellency.
Listen, Lebedev, began the prince, quite overwhelmed. Do act quietly and don't make a scandal, Lebedev. I ask you, I entreat you. No one must know, no one. Mind, in that case only I will help you.
Be assured, most honourable, most worthy of princes, be assured that the whole matter shall be buried within my heart, cried the Lebedev in a paroxysm of exultation. I'd give every drop of my blood, illustrious prince. I am a poor wretch in soul and spirit, but ask the veriest scoundrel whether he would prefer to deal with one like himself or with a noble-hearted man like you, and there is no doubt as to his choice. He'll answer that he prefers the noble-hearted man, and there you have the triumph of virtue. Au revoir, honored prince. You and I together, softly, softly. End of chapter 9.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.